We are in 1 Samuel, and we're picking up at about chapter 25. And David, well, I guess it depends on how you want to look at it. If you want to look at it in terms of the way the world would look at it, David's at probably one of the worst spots in his whole life. You know, it's just like the wheels have fallen off. He's running for his life. He was the commander of the Israelite army, and now he's on the run from the Israelite army. His family's in hiding, and the only people who will follow him is kind of this motley crew of troublemakers, and just everything that could potentially go wrong seems to have gone wrong. So if you look at it from an external perspective, this is one of the darkest times in David's life. If you look at it from a spiritual perspective, and you look at it from the standpoint of the quality of man that David is and is becoming, as we read through, what we're constantly impressed by is the quality of human being he is, and that's just being honed, as just being further polished into the kind of man that he'll need to be when he is king. And so it depends on how you want to look at it. David is either in the worst time in his life, or these are some of the best years of his life. And you think about it with like a young married couple. They get married and you're instantly broke. That's just kind of the way it is. You're young and married and broke, and you look at it and you say, man, that could be the worst time in somebody's life. They have no money, and they're at the lowest point in their career, and just, you know, everything that could be hard seems to be hard. But then when you talk to older couples and they talk back about the early years of their marriage, what do they often say? Oh, those were great years, weren't they? You know, just us and a box of cereal trying to make it. You know, I mean, it just depends on your perspective. So David here is in some hard times, but he's becoming quite a high-quality individual. We've seen him spare Saul's life in chapter 24, and when he could have taken it, and yet he stayed the hand of the 400 men that were with him and said, no, we won't hurt the Lord's anointed. That takes some real strong character. Here in chapter 25, we'll begin the chapter with this kind of transition in that Samuel dies. So Samuel is the last judge and the end of an era of judges. So Samuel will die, and it says all Israel gathered together, and they mourned for him and buried him at his house in Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. So Samuel ends that era, and now you have no more judges left. Israel mourns his loss. And now you only have kings. You'll never again have a judge who is delivering Israel. The wilderness of Paran, where it mentions that David will go to, if you look, that's the wrong pointer. This pointer. There we go. Okay. So if you look, here is the Dead Sea right here. So this is the lower half, what we would often call the area of Judea, of Israel. The wilderness of Paran is right down in this region. So he's really wandered to the furthest reaches of the south country of Israel. He's in an area that is kind of Israel and kind of not. It's kind of a blurred area. It's a no man's land. Shepherds and nomads live in that region. It was the area actually that Israel will have spent a fair amount of time when they were wandering in the wilderness. This was part of the territory of wandering in the wilderness. And so that's where David now flees to. So he's kind of getting further and further and further away from the main territory of Israel now that things have really degraded with Saul. And that is what introduces us to who will eventually become his wife, Abigail. So in verse 2, it says there was a man in Maon, whose business was in Carmel, And the man was very rich, and he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And it came about while he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. The man's name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. And the woman was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his dealings, and he was a Calebite. So the region that we're now going to deal with is not Mount Carmel. So these two can be confused. Mount Carmel's up here. But we're going to actually deal with this region down here called Carmel. And it's right in the southern country of the nation, right around the area where David and his men had been hanging out. In fact, if you look at it, this area that says the Negev, if you go to the previous map, here is that Negev. So it gives you an idea. That region is where David was, and it's fairly desolate. It's good for sheep herding, if you're willing to kind of travel around from one spot to another and do the grazing and everything. So David's been hanging out there, and this man Nabal has a lot of sheep that his shepherds have been watching over that have been in the same region as David and his men. And now it's come to the time of the shearing of the sheep. So they're going to gather all those animals together. They're going to shear them. And they brought them out of the wilderness. So it's you've had the shepherds out there, and they've been all over the place. And now they're all collected in one place. And from a ranching perspective, this is the harvest, right? This is the payoff. Now we shear the sheep, and it's great. This is where we gather the wool of our labor. I guess it's not the fruits of our labor. It's the wool of our labor. And so it's a very prosperous time. And so there's feasting and festivities and things like that. And so Nabal is the head of this whole business or organization, and he has a wife named Abigail. And what we know at this point is that Nabal, whose name means worthless, by the way, and that will be referenced later on, is a real low quality individual, and his wife Abigail is a real high quality individual. So a couple of things for us to understand about that is, one, the Bible exists in the real world, doesn't it? Are good people always married to good people? Not necessarily. If you're going to serve the Lord, you may find yourself unequally yoked. Abigail certainly did. And what we're going to see is that Abigail has to function as best as she can in a righteous way while being married to an unrighteous man. And that's a very difficult thing to do. Because biblically speaking, she's supposed to be in submission to him as much as she can. But when he just flat out does the wrong thing, she's not going to be able to be in submission to him. And so there's this constant friction that's created by it. So the Bible is not, it doesn't deal in theoreticals. That's my point. This is how life actually works. God's people have often found themselves in circumstances where they are either married or connected to people who do not share the same values as them, and that makes life hard. That certainly is, in one sense, a lesson for us. If you have a choice in who you marry, don't marry a Nabal, right? That's one lesson out of it. But it's likely Abigail didn't have that choice. You know, that's the other thing we have to consider is, it's Abigail probably, she was probably given in marriage by her father. That was very typical. And was married to a man that she had no say-so in. And so in that case, life just becomes hard and is full of difficult things. And it's not easy to be righteous. It's not easy to be faithful to God in such circumstances where your value system is very different than the value system of those around you. Nabal is a very good businessman. He seems to have done well for himself in terms of making money. But how has he gone about that process of making money? It tells you in verse 3. That's right. He was harsh and evil in his dealings. That's the answer. So he progressed in business by not being a good person. Does that ever happen? Ever people who are successful in business that are unsuccessful at humanity? It doesn't always work that way. You can be both, but there is certainly a temptation there to say, well, this is business, so I don't have to worry about my morals. In fact, that's where we get phrases like, wait, look, don't take it personally, it's just business. That's often a phrase that is said right after somebody acted like a lowlife. So Nabal is that kind of a guy. He's got a lot of money, but he doesn't have a lot of character. And so there's quite a lot of lessons there in that. So when David hears that this shearing is going on, he will take 10 of his young men in verse 5, and he's going to say to them, go up to Carmel, visit Nabal, and greet him in my name. Now that's an important point we want to remember. These men are going as emissaries for David. Greet him in my name, and thus you shall say, have a long life, peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. Now I've heard that you have shearers, now your shepherds have been with us, and we've not insulted them, nor have they missed anything all the days they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you, therefore let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a festive day, this day of the sheep shearing. Please give whatever you find at hand to your servants, and to your son David. Now David, in his initial entreaty to Nabal, what's he hoping for? What's he want? Yeah, either an invitation to the festivities, or really even probably, my guess is maybe even a little less than that, just some food. Would you be willing to give us some things? In other words, you prospered, and part of the reason you prospered is because my men have protected your men out there. David's a guy who his whole existence is dependent on what he can scrape together at this point, right? He doesn't have a job. He's functioned as a mercenary. We've kind of seen that. But he's essentially existed on the goodwill of other people. And so here he's asking Nabal for that goodwill, but not with undue reason, right? David's been out there in the wilderness, and his men easily could have stolen a sheep here or there and gotten away with it. But they haven't. Instead, they've protected these men. They've acted in a righteous way. So he uses phrases like, you know, your servants and your son David. So there's that humility in it. And so he sends the young men. And Nabal's answer will be in verse 10. Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David and who is the son of Jesse? Now here's something we should catch right off the bat. When he says, who is David and who is the son of Jesse? There's two ways he could say that. Who's David? I don't know who that is. But when he says, who is David and who is the son of Jesse? What does that tell you? He does know who he is. And who in Israel didn't know who David was, right? He was a pretty famous guy. He's famous now for not being in the good graces of the king. He's also famous for killing Goliath. Remember the whole song that all the maidens sang? Saul has killed his thousands, David killed his 10,000s. He was a famous military officer in the kingdom before that. So Nabal is not saying, I don't know who this guy is. Why would I give him anything? This is a slight. Who is David and who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are each breaking away from his master. Now there's the other thing that tells you he knows who he is. Why does he mention a servant breaking away from his master? What's that referencing? David and Saul. Yeah, that's the reference there. He's like, there's lots of guys who are running away from their master. He is doing the exact opposite of what David has done. David has come with humility, and he's coming and just saying, you're a nothing. Who are you? Lots of guys run away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I've slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men whose origin I do not know? So you get a little bit of that taste of that evil and harsh in his dealings here from Nabal. And so they David's young men retraced their way, went back, and the Kadim told them according to all these words. And David's answer is pretty easy to understand. David said to his men, "Each of you gird on his sword." So David's response is immediate, and it is very, very strong, because he showed every bit of humility and respect to Nabal, and he got nothing but total and complete disrespect back for Nabal. Men love being disrespected, don't they? It's just like our favorite thing. It just immediately sends his blood pressure right through the roof, and David tells his men, "Everybody grab your sword. We're going down." And so he's just, I think of it this way, he saw red and kind of temporarily loses his mind. He's just decided, "I'm going to go down." I can't believe he treated, and from David's perspective, not only has he said mean things about David, but he's humiliated David's men. Now, we don't like that either. You know, as human beings, when somebody insults us, that's one thing, but when somebody insults people we care about, it's almost worse, isn't it? So here, David just says, "That's it, we're going to go down and we're going to slaughter him." And is this in keeping with David's character that we've seen up to this point? Have we ever seen this sort of bloodlust from David? I haven't. I mean, I've not seen any indication of it, which is what puts me in the category of thinking he's kind of moved into temporary insanity. That just, he just so mad. Mad for himself, mad for his men, mad that they've been so nice, and then this guy's been so mean. And so he's going to, I'm just going to handle it. I'm just going to let him have it. And verse 14, one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, "Behold, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he scorned them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we were not insulted, nor did we miss anything as long as we went about with them. While we were in the fields, they were a wall to us, both by night and by day, all the time we were with them, tending the sheep." So this young man that goes to Abigail is not one of David's young men. This is one of Nabal's young men. And he goes to Abigail. Now, why would he go to Abigail versus going to Nabal? Pretty much, right? Yeah. She is described as beautiful and intelligent, and he's harsh and evil. And a reputation says something. You're not even going to waste your time talking to that guy. Which is another very interesting lesson about character, isn't it? Character builds reputation, and you might miss opportunities if you're known for a certain character. They're not even going to. He doesn't even get the chance to see the error of his way because of his past choices. Nobody's going to talk to him about it. So Abigail will be told the truth. And this young man speaks that really what the 10 young men said to Nabal was true, that David and his men had been very good to them. And then he'll finish in verse 17 saying, "Now therefore know and consider what you should do, for evil is plotted against our master and against all his household, and he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him." So this young man sees the writing on the wall, tells Abigail, this is going to be very bad. The way he dealt with this, this is going to turn out really bad for the whole household. So Abigail has to make a very quick decision. Now, there is a lot that is put in this story that can muddy the waters. And I'm just going to deal with it up front before we even talk about what Abigail does. Abigail is going to do some things that are going to seem like she's not a very good wife to Nabal. She is going to go against his orders and bring food. What did he already say? No. She's going to say, "What we did was wrong." Now, she'll put it on herself. She'll say, "Look, it's, you know, my fault." But she'll also say, "My husband's name is Nabal and worthless is his name." So, you know, how many guys would like their wife to say, "Yeah, my husband, his name means worthless, and he was well named." So there's one argument that people will make is, here is this woman, and she's not being a good wife. She's not being submissive. My argument is the people who say that miss the complete point. Entirely miss the point. Why is she in a position where she has to do things that are the exact opposite of what her husband wanted? That's right. Because her husband is a bad leader. And he's put her in a predicament where she has to decide, do I save lives? Because that's what we're talking about right here, right? If David's not stopped, what happens? Yeah, everybody dies. David said, put gird up your swords. He knows how to use that thing. They're not fooling. So she has to decide, do I submit to my husband's will or do I save lives? Now imagine for a second you put that in a common circumstance or something more modern today. Imagine you saw a child out running in the road and a car coming, and the woman, a wife, went to go save the life of the child, run out there, and her husband said, don't you do it, you just let that child die. Should she listen to her husband or should she save the child's life? Is anybody in any sense going to say it's a good idea for her to let the child die? Total insanity, right? But that's exactly the same circumstance here. She knows, what are those men coming with? What did David say? Gird on your sword. So I either do whatever Nabal wants, which we have every indication she does most of the time. But in this case, if she does that, people die. So what's the righteous thing? It's just clear. The only reason there's any sort of conflict is because of sin. The conflict isn't because of Abigail. You know, you want to see the problem in the marriage? Trace the problem back. Where's the problem in the marriage? It's in the husband, and it's in the husband's character, his sin. You trace it back to the sin. That's what causes the problem. You think Abigail and Nabal have a good communication in their marriage? You think they got a lot of trust in their marriage? No. Do you think they got a lot of joy in their marriage? No. So all these things are missing. Why? Sin. That's the answer. Here is a clear biblical example of what sin does. It does to our relationships. It did to their marriage. All sorts of things. It's just an awful thing. And we don't want to make the mistake of blaming Abigail, who's doing her best to fix the problem, with creating the problem. Those are two different things, aren't they? So Abigail's going to gather all of this food together, put it on a bunch of donkeys, and send it ahead of her in stages so that they will meet up with David. But by the time she gets to David, David will have food and bread. He'll have bread and sheep and wine and roasted grain and raisins and figs that will all have been sent ahead of time. So she is pretty savvy. It said she was intelligent. She's an intelligent woman. She figures out, by the time I get to David, I want him to already have his temper volume turning down. I want him already, he's kind of de-escalating. Abigail is going to teach us a clinic on being a peacemaker. That's what she's doing. When somebody's entirely fired up, the way David is that the time to try and talk to him? He's not going to listen right now. He's just seeing red. So you got to de-escalate it a little bit. And how do you de-escalate things with a man? Food. It's the secret. So she's going to just dial it down a little bit and give him a gift. Now, a gift is a good, I mean, that's a very practical thing, isn't it? Imagine for a second, you had somebody that you had a real problem with, and they had a real problem with you, and there's just been friction and tension in that relationship, and you don't know where to start. Well, what happens if you just send them a little gift? You know, you're in the grocery store or whatever, and you saw something, and you buy it, and it wouldn't really even matter how much it was. It doesn't have to be an extravagant gift. That you wrap it up, and you put a note on it, and you write their name, and you say, I saw this and I thought of you, and, you know, Merry Christmas or whatever. Would that do something? I mean, it's not going to hurt, is it? It's not going to make the tension worse. So that's what she does. Like I said, she's going to teach us a clinic here on how to be a peacemaker. Anybody have anything on that, by the way? Okay. So then when you get to verse 23, it says, when Abigail saw David, she hurried and dismounted from her donkey and fell on her face before David and bowed herself to the ground. Now, before we get any further, there are several things in this one verse that are worth noting. When Abigail saw David, she, what's the word? When Abigail saw David, she dismounted and did it in what way? Quickly. She hurried. Does that make a difference? Think of just a silly example of this. You ever had somebody, you're driving in your car and you come up to a crosswalk and you see that there's a pedestrian there, and so you stop your car even though you're in a hurry, but you stop your car and they just walk across as slowly as humanly possible, even though they're like 15 and have perfectly fine legs. You ever been irritated by that? But on the other hand, if you have somebody and you stop and they kind of give you a wave and they, you know, even if they just make the motion like they're hurrying, you know, it's like the legs aren't moving any faster, but they kind of tried. That does something for you. So that's what Abigail does. She doesn't just, okay, here I am. She dismounts quickly, runs up, and then she bows her head down to the ground. Is any of this Abigail's fault, by the way? Absolutely none at all. But she's going to fix it. So she shows every sign of humility. She fell at his feet and said, on me alone, my Lord, be the blame. Before she says anything else, first words out of her mouth are, I'm sorry, it's my fault. Could we argue that that's not really even true? She's taking the blame, but really, should she? Does she deserve to take the blame? Maybe that's a better way to put it. See, I don't think she deserves to, but she says, on me, O Lord, be the blame. There's a great example of somebody who said, look, I will take the fault. I'll take the damage if it means mending this relationship. First words out of her mouth. And please let your maidservant speak to you and listen to the words of your maidservant. Please do not let my Lord pay attention to this worthless man, Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name and follies with him, but I, your maidservant, did not see the young man of my Lord whom you sent. So she doesn't defend Nabal, and then people get stuck on that. If you want your wife to defend you, you better be a defendable man. That's my answer to you. And then she says, the blame's on me because the young men came and I didn't see them. I wasn't attentive enough to my duties. In every way trying to diffuse this. Verse 26, now therefore my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood and from avenging yourself by your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek evil against my Lord be as Nabal. Now, she does something really tricky here, but it's really, really smart. Says she's intelligent. Let's pay attention to this intelligent woman. Has David agreed to not kill anybody yet? But she just acted like he had. Look at what she says in verse 26. My Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood and from avenging yourself by your own hand. She's going to talk to him like he's already decided to do the right thing. And that's a pretty good technique. Because she is assuming the best in him. I know you love the Lord. I know God is with you. And I know you're not the kind of man that would just kill people because you were mad. And you know what you are doing if you're David? See, we want to have a sympathetic mind. Put it through David's. What's she doing to David right now? she's making him think, and he's going, yeah, I don't want to be that kind of guy. Yeah, and I did kind of forget about Jehovah there for a minute. And wait a second, this is about my character, not about Nabal's. And she has put him in the position of stopping and thinking about what it says about him, and that's exactly what you want to do. She is diffusing this situation by appealing to his character that he's not doing a very good job of showing tonight, but has shown over the course of his life. If you do this, by the way, with your spouse, you will win lots and lots of points. Because what you do with your spouse is you assume the best version of them is somewhere in there. You're assuming with your spouse that even in a time of disagreement, that you know they want to do the right thing, and even though there's some debate over that right now, you know that they really deep down are trying to do the right thing and want to serve God and do right, and you want to help them to do that. And that Abigail is giving David that benefit of the doubt. So when you're disagreeing with, say, your spouse, or you're disagreeing with a brother in Christ, or a sister in Christ for that matter, I mean, anybody who shares, that you know and can have confidence shares your same values, this is a good technique that Abigail gives us. And it matches the sorts of things that we see in the rest of the Bible, the New Testament teachings on being a peacemaker. And well, even the New Testament says if your brother has something against you, what are you supposed to do? Yeah, leave your gift at the altar and seek them out. Is that what Abigail does? Yeah. David's the one with the problem, but Abigail runs to him. So all of these fit together. And then let's see here, verse 27. Now let this gift which your maidservant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who accompany my Lord. Please forgive the transgression of your maidservant. The Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil will not be found in you all your days. Should anyone rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, then the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God, but the lives of your enemies he will sling out as from the hollow of a sling. Now, what she's doing right now is referring to the fact that she understands that God is with David. And she's also making reference to something that she probably already knows about, because it was probably heard about through the grapevine, that has David had any chance to kill Saul? But he didn't do it. Why? He's the Lord's anointed. Yeah, he says, I'm not going to do it. Who's going to put... David had decided a long time ago, who's going to fight my battles for me? Am I going to kill Saul, or am I going to leave God to take care of that whenever his time is fit? It's God's discretion. She's referring to that. Look, you don't worry about your enemies. God will sling them out like the stone from the sling of a... a stone from a sling, which, by the way, references another battle, doesn't it? When did David ever use a sling? Yeah, Goliath. How'd that work? Right? So, be the better man. That's the answer. Be the better man. And when the Lord does for my Lord, according to all the good that he's spoken concerning you, and appoints you ruler over Israel, this will not cause grief or a troubled heart to my Lord, both by having shed blood without cause and by my Lord having avenged himself. So, she references another thing, which is, especially when somebody's angry, what are they not thinking about? Not thinking about tomorrow. Right? If you were thinking about tomorrow, you'd watch your words when you're angry, wouldn't you? Because you can say angry words. We even have a song about angry words. And you can say angry words, and they come out fast, but you can't unring that bell. And so here, she says, I don't want this to cause you grief or a troubled heart later on. You're going to be king someday. And you don't want this blot on your record of that time where you went in and massacred Nabal and his men. And so she does this, and David will then respond and say, blessed be the Lord God of Israel who sent you this day to meet me. And blessed be your discernment, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from bloodshed and from avenging myself by my own hand. David immediately recognizes and is grateful for several different things. And the first thing he's grateful for is, blessed be God. He recognizes, Abigail, you were a gift from God. Glory be to God that he sent you to me so I wouldn't do something stupid that I'd regret the rest of my life. You know, that's a pretty solid prayer for us to pray, by the way, I think, is that if in those times where we're going to do something dumb, I don't know when it's going to be. If I knew it was going to be, I wouldn't do the dumb thing. But when those times come, God, could you please send somebody to keep me from doing something that I'll wish I'd never done. Because she is a blessing from God to him, and he blesses her for meeting him, and he blesses her discernment, that she was aware enough to know what the real problem was and to address it. So, anybody have anything on that chapter or that series of events there with David and Abigail? Okay. This is the day, and the Bible's full of stories like this, but this is the day a woman saved the nation. She saved the nation by saving the character of the king. And so David will go back and not do what he was going to do. And he tells her in verse 34, he says, surely there would not have been left to Nabal until the morning light as much as one male. That was my plan. I was going down and we were just going to kill them all. So David received from her hand what she brought him and said to her, go up to your house in peace. See, I've listened to you and granted your request. And then it says, Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house like the feast of a king. So Nabal, he just thinks, boy, everything's great. But what's been happening in the background? How close to death was he? And here's a verse that I use quite often with people in drinking. Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. Here you have Nabal, and did drinking make him happy? He was very merry. He was very happy. But he was also very drunk. And so this is a good verse to use on one of the problems with alcohol is that you have to watch your motives. Because a lot of times people say it's something that feels so good can't be wrong. But that's a dangerous road to walk, isn't it? And so Nabal, he was very drunk, and she didn't tell him anything at all until the morning light. So he wasn't even somebody you could communicate with. That's another thing that in sobriety does, is that it makes you somebody who just absolutely worthless as far as decision making. Nobody can even talk to you. But in the morning, when the wine had gone out, Nabal, his wife, told him these things, and his heart died within him, so he became as a stone. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. So in the end, Nabal ends up dying, but who does it? God does it. God. Oh, wait. What did you said Abigail? No. Oh, yeah. No, Abigail didn't kill Nabal. That would be a twist. But no. Yeah. No. Who kills Nabal is the Lord. Abigail saves David, and so David doesn't have to do anything. And that's the answer to the whole thing, right? Did David have to avenge himself? No, not at all. It all worked out just fine. And so when Nabal dies, David, being the wise man that he is, says, hey, Abigail's a single woman. I could use a wife like that. And so then he ends up marrying her. And one of the interesting things that we have with Abigail is that she really will somewhat disappear from history by the time you get to David and Bathsheba and Solomon and all those sorts of things. She's really just disappeared. It's quite likely that she had passed away and never had to see all of that sort of problems that the kingdom faced, because she seems to be gone doesn't really show up in the records at that point, which points towards this idea that she probably just wasn't even alive at that point. So she potentially didn't even have to see any of the darker years of David's life, consequently. Anybody have any comments or questions on that chapter? Okay, well, the next chapter we'll cover fairly quickly, but because it's somewhat of a repeat of what we saw in chapter 24, David will be out in this territory. This is a wilderness near Ziph. And you get a bit of an idea. This picture gives you a bit of an idea of how hard it would be to hunt somebody down in this territory, right? Because David and his men could be on one side of a mountain, and you could be on the other side. You'd have no idea where they were. It's just very lots of movement in the terrain, and there's lots of caves and things of that nature. And it's at this place where Saul will go out again and attempt to capture David. And he'll be given a tip by the Ziphites that David is hiding in the hill of Hakkelah, which is before Jeshimon. So Saul will arise and he'll go down to the wilderness of Ziph, having with him 3,000 chosen of Israel to search for David in the wilderness of Ziph. And so Saul is camping near that hill where he'd heard that David was, and David was staying in the wilderness. And in verse 4, David sent out spies, and he knew that Saul was definitely coming. So David is actually going to arise and go to where Saul is. And David, with a couple of his men, will actually go down into the camp. And so in verse 6, it says, David said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, saying, "Who will go down with me to Saul in the camp?" And Abishai said, "I will go down with you." So David and Abishai came to the people by night. And behold, Saul lay sleeping inside the circle of the camp with his spear stuck in the ground at his head. And Abner and the people were lying around him. Abner, if you remember, is Saul's uncle and the general of the army. So they've all encircled around Saul. So Saul's in the middle of the camp and all these other soldiers around him. David asked a couple of his mightiest men, "Who will go with me?" And they go right down into the center of the tent. And David will say to Abishai, "Don't kill him." Abishai wants to kill him. David will say in verse 10, "As the Lord lives, surely the Lord will strike him, or his day will come that he dies, he will go down into battle and perish." Now, here's my question. David goes down into the camp. He has every opportunity to kill Saul, tells his men, "Don't do it," but instead says, "Look, if the Lord wants to kill him, he'll do it." Has David learned anything from Abigail? That's the message of Nabal, isn't it? And so he's going to leave him. What he will end up doing is he'll take the spear and the jug of water, and then they'll cross over to the other side, verse 13, and stand on top of the mountain at a distance with a large area between them so that he can't get attacked. And he'll call to Abner and point out, "Look, I just was in there, and you didn't do a very good job of guarding him." And his whole point with doing this is what? Why is David doing this? It's all purely to point out to Saul, "I'm not your enemy." David, here with Saul, reminds me a lot of Jesus with Judas. How many chances did Jesus give Judas to change his way? Even when he came up to him with the mob, he said, "Are you going to betray me with a kiss?" I mean, he knew. He knew what he was going to do every step of the way. Every chance, giving him a chance to repent. And Saul, he keeps giving, David does that here with Saul. And so David is providing one more opportunity here for that to happen. And will tell Saul, "Why are you pursuing me? And look what you've done. You've driven me out, so I can't go and worship God like other Jews. I'm driven from my homeland. What have I done to you? You're essentially telling me, go serve other gods. I haven't done anything against you." And verse 21, Saul will say, "I have sinned. Return my son David, for I will not harm you again, because my life was precious in your sight this day. Behold, I have played the fool and have committed a serious error." Now, he's going to say that, but what's he going to turn around and do once this scenario is over, once this moment's gone? He's going to go right back to it. Yeah, that's it. He's going to go right back to it. So words are talk's cheap. And so they have this really what will end up being the final interchange between David and Saul. And from there, David is going to leave the country of Israel and begin a new phase as the final events unfold in the reign of Saul. And we'll cover that next week. Does anybody have any comments or questions? Okay, we'll close down there. Pick up chapter 27 next week.